my vagina. It's embarrassing because it's not politically correct. I mean, I know it should have happened in a bath with salt grains from the Dead Sea, Enya playing in the background, me loving my woman self. I know the story. Vaginas are beautiful. Our self-hatred is only the internalized repression of the patriarchal culture. It isn't real. Pussies unite. I know all of it. Like, if we grew up in a culture where we were taught that fat thighs were beautiful, we'd all be lying on our backs, pounding down milkshakes and Krispy Kremes, spending our days thigh expanding. But we didn't grow up in that culture. I hated these thighs, and I hated my vagina even more. I thought it was incredibly ugly. I pitied anyone who had to go down there. In order to survive, I began to picture something else between my legs. I imagined furniture. Light cotton comforters with little velvet settees, leopard rugs, or pretty things. Silk handkerchiefs, quilted pot holders, or place settings. I grew so accustomed to this that I lost all memory of even having a vagina. Whenever a man was inside of me, I pictured him inside a mink-lined muffler or a Chinese bowl.
So Valentine's Day's coming up, and for the last 14 years or so, that's meant not just big revenues for florists and chocolate manufacturers, but also productions of Eve Ensler's classic play, The Vagina Monologues. Under the auspices of the nonprofit organization V-Day, hundreds, if not thousands, of colleges and community productions have taken place in over 140 countries. 3 years ago, on the play's 15th anniversary, V-Day launched the 1 Billion Rising campaign, a global activist movement to stop violence against women. 1 Billion Rising holds annual flash mobs and public events to call attention to the struggles of women for equality and safety. And like most feminist projects, and especially massive, well-funded ones, V-Day and 1 Billion Rising have been controversial since their inception. This year, some of the rumblings within feminist communities exploded to the surface when the right-wing news site Campus Reform reported that Mount Holyoke's Project Theater had decided to cancel its annual production of The Vagina Monologues because, quote, at its core, the show offers an extremely narrow perspective on what it means to be a woman. Gender is a wide and varied experience, one that cannot simply be reduced to biological or anatomical distinctions. Today, I'll be talking with a number of feminist scholars and activists about some of the criticisms that have been made of the play and the movements that it spawned. First up, Christine Cooper, whose 2007 article, Worrying About Vaginas, offers one of the most comprehensive analyses I've seen of what the play and the V-Day movement do and don't do. Christine, thanks so much for joining us. So you write, the monologue form, as it takes shape in this play and as it, in turn, shapes how audiences experience women's perceptions of their vaginas, has grave consequences for the feminist politics that the show popularizes. And you question what you term the subjectivized vagina. So what's your concern about the focus on vaginas?
There's a conflation that happens in the monologues where the vagina becomes the equivalence of the self, of the speaker. And that happens in a number of the monologues. There's one about a man who looks at a woman's vagina until she transforms and has this feeling that now she loves her vagina also. And he says that he needs to see her, and he's looking at her vagina. And so her vagina becomes her. And although Ensler, in response to this whole transgender Mount Holyoke controversy, if we can call it that, has said that she's never defined what a woman is in terms of biology, the play itself enacts this kind of substitution. And so vaginas have feelings. Vaginas become selves, and the selves that are speaking are articulating how their vaginas feel. And so there's all of these ways that the collapsing of categories leads to a kind of biological determinism of gender, even if that may not be what Ensler herself was aiming for.
one of the things I've been trying to figure out is, why is it that this play, you know, which really was just a play, has been so catalyzing for so many people and draws such strong reactions from people that love it or people that hate it?
The monologue form is really seductive. I think you have a woman standing on stage speaking her truth. Like, that is the framework of the vagina monologues. And that erases all context that led to that truth. Another central monologue is the Coochie Snorcher one. And the introduction to it in the book version explains that Ensler has encountered all these women in homeless shelters, and that monologue emerges from her conversation with this woman in a homeless shelter. And in the monologue itself, it's about her being abused as a child and then having this encounter with a neighbor who teaches her all these things about her vagina, and she learns to have pleasure. And so the monologue allows the speaker to be in that moment of transformation. It's totally this all-encompassing, mystified experience of pleasure. And the context within which this story emerged is gone. The fact that this woman has no home, that she's living in a shelter. I'm pretty sure that that's one of the voices that's coded as a woman of color also. In some of the scripts have voice designations and some of them don't. And they're allowed to just be kind of the normal white voice, I would say, of feminism. So it's both her difference, the Coochie Snorcher speaker's difference, kind of disappears in this pleasure in finding her sexuality and claiming it. And I'm not saying that there's a problem with, you know, I don't want to be saying that they're, you know, no one should have pleasure or whatever. Like, but if we isolate the person or the speaker, in the case of the monologue form, from the conditions and the context that gives meaning to that speaker and shapes who that person is, then we consume it as if this is the isolated individual subject of liberalism, right? Like the isolated individual who stands before the law in the United States. It's a very, I think it connects in so many ways to an ideology of individualism that exists in this country, at the same time that it also connects to waves of consciousness raising within the feminist movement. So there's also that component, and they overlap. And I think that it ends up being this very comfortable way of accessing women's experience. But it also determines, because of the way the monologues work, it determines who gets to speak and whose stories are on stage. It limits, at the same time, that appears to be this transgressive celebratory moment of claiming the self.
But these productions also, as we were discussing before we started, do raise money for local organizations. That's part of the mandate. If you sign on to do a production of the monologues, that you're going to give all of the money has to go to local organizations that work against violence. You know, Eve Ensler herself, I think, has raised tons and tons of money for New Orleans and for Haiti and for Africa. Isn't this a good thing?
Yeah, I mean, it's never black and white. There's never good and bad. And one of the things that I'm interested in is the way that ideas that are really enabling carry ideological baggage, they carry philosophical baggage that sometimes undermines their capacity to be fully realized. And so if we don't pay attention to the ways that the ideas carry this baggage, then we potentially create power dynamics that undermine the efforts that we are making. So it's not so much that I would want it to stop, because I think it's fabulous that local organizations are getting funding. I mean, they're precisely the people who need funding and get, you know, overlooked in terms of national giving and things like that. But there's a subtlety that gets lost, and maybe a thoughtfulness that could be mined and used, and that might enable more people to feel active, you know, like to be energized and actually doing something and not just feeling good about claiming themselves. Because I guess there's the risk of the politics of this play ending with people walking out smiling and able to say the word vagina.
So I wanted to ask about the international dimension of V-Day. You've written about that. You talk about what you call missionary feminism or international hegemonic feminism. Talk about that a little.
Well, it's interesting that in this play, and V-Day has sort of restructured itself since I wrote this article. Now you can pick one of two formats in order to perform or stage one of two different formats. And one is called a memory, a monologue, a rant, and a prayer. And that includes writing that isn't Ensler's. It's pieces by Edward Albee or Michael Cunningham or Maya Angelou, Edwidge Danicott. There's a range of voices there, which I think is kind of interesting. You can't see the script unless you sign up, so I don't know exactly what those pieces are. On the website, it talks about the groups who opt for that, pick 5 to 10 pieces from Ensler's script, and then also have these other voices that they can access. Within the Vagina Monologues itself, the voices of women of color and the Bosnian woman's monologue, so they're both not the hegemonic, heteronormative sort of voice of the monologues. They are the ones that the violence actually is articulated in. Like, they are the women who are raped. The Bosnian woman's monologue, first of all, it's called My Vagina Was My Village. So it's in the past tense. She doesn't really have a vagina anymore because half of it has come off in her hand because of the violence that's been done to her. And she is utterly unrecovered. Like, there is like this no recovery for that speaker in the monologue. And it's interesting that it's the other, right, that actually becomes or bears the weight of representing sexual violence against women. And that doesn't happen in the other monologues. And so there's, that's one dynamic that's sort of questionable, so that the audience then can sympathize with that person, the speaker on the stage, and feel empathy and maybe donate funds. But the people in the audience have their vaginas, right? Like, they're always still intact. And so sympathy becomes the way of finding sameness between difference. Again, I'm not sure at this point whether there are other monologues that have updated that, or whether the Bosnian woman still is representative in the text as she is in the version that I was working on when I wrote the article. The monologue also is split. Like, the speaker has a split consciousness where she talks about her past and in this green village, and there's all this beautiful water and pastoral, idyllic, unmodernized, unindustrial in her pre-rape existence. And then that idealization then makes the violence all the more stark. And it is exactly that kind of split of seeing sort of the West and the rest, that the rest of the world that hasn't yet been westernized is somehow more primitive or more pastoralized or idealized, like whether you're going to read that in a positive way or spin it in a positive way or spin it in a negative way. They need to be civilized, right, in the sort of colonialist discourse. But the idealization is also a part of the Orientalist aesthetic. And so Ensler is using this set of tropes that has been involved in colonial discourse. It's hard to have real tangible political action side by side with what really is an imperialist Orientalist aesthetic. And I'm not sure that people, your average viewer of the play, is gonna pay attention to that maybe our sympathy is built on something that actually was used to disempower, and that the speaker on the stage speaking her truth is actually disempowered by disrobing in front of us and telling us her truth. I don't know if you're familiar with Leslie Jameson's essay collection, The Empathy Exams. It's I think it came out in 2013 or 2014, but it's a really interesting interrogation of the concept of empathy. And she describes empathy as precariously perched between being a gift and an invasion. So we both, whenever we are being empathetic with someone, like it's, you know, valued. We like all want to be sympathetic to one another. If we listen to one another, we'll understand each other better. We'll treat each other better. And in terms of, you know, Ensler's politics, if we listen to each other, we can potentially change this whole world, violence against women and so on. But one thing that Jameson really won't let go of, and I think is valuable, is that there's always a gap that you can't ever fully imagine yourself into somebody else's position. The empathy is this act of imagination. And when we imagine ourselves in someone else's situation, we're doing that based on our own experience and our own knowledge. And so we're starting from self. And we can't really get rid of that. And she, you know, like this whole conversation that we're having here, she's not necessarily interested in valuing or devaluing empathy. She's just looking and interrogating how it works. But one of the things that I heard her say in an interview is that we can't be too confident or comfortable in that gap being closed between the empathizer and the one who needs empathy. If we become too confident that gap can be closed, then we oversimplify the relationship and we erase the possibility of recognizing someone's difference. And so I think there's the non-self-consciousness of Ensler's play and of productions of Ensler's play has potentially that danger of not recognizing that gap.
Christine Cooper is an essayist and author living in New England. Her article, Worrying About Vaginas, appeared in the journal Signs in 2007. Christine, thanks so much.
Thank you.